I have a dream.
The wall must go.
China, Princess of Wales.
Into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
Now, for this week in history, we are putting the spotlight on one of the biggest names in global politics. Benazir Bhutto ruled Pakistan during a tumultuous period. She was elected twice, and her campaign to regain power a third time ended in her assassination in 2007 by the Pakistan Taliban. Tonight, we take you to the moment her time in office began, victory in the November 16 election in 1988, making her the first female leader in the Muslim world. Australian-Pakistani political analyst Samina Yasmeen took up her position at the University of WA the same year. She is now Emeritus Professor and Director of the Centre for Muslim States and Society. And she's here to tell us more. Samina, welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Benazir Bhutto once said, "I didn't choose this life, it chose me." Was she born to lead Pakistan?
She was born in a family where political participation was a very important role. And also the fact that her father was also the Prime Minister of Pakistan in the 1970s. And before that, he was a very favored minister for the then military dictator. Basically meant that in the family that she grew up, politics was everywhere. And she had no option but to be involved in political life. And so in a way, she was right. But it's also that the system that she grew up in, the family background that she grew up in, also created the space in which she was groomed to be the next political leader after her father, over and above her brothers. So in a way, yes, the politics chose her, life chose her to be in that position. But I think the position that she was born into, the family she was born into, played a very important role in this whole process.
So to understand Benazir Bhutto, we really need to know about her father. What happened to him when she was 24?
Well, his father, to give you a sense, he was one of the very intelligent, visionary political leaders in Pakistan who came up with the idea of Islamic socialism at a time when people were talking both about socialism and Islam. Before that, as I had said, he was very close to the former military dictator, General Ayub Khan, who had become a president, and he took a liking to Ali Bhutto. So Ali Bhutto was very popular, a very powerful minister in his ministry, in his cabinet. But after 1965 war, their paths diverged because Ali Bhutto didn't really like the way General Ayub had decided to negotiate on Kashmir. And so as a result of that, he set up Pakistan People's Party, or PPP. Ali Bhutto led that party from basically nothing, and using Islamic socialism, he created a whole environment in which at least the West Pakistanis were very pro-Ali Bhutto, or Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. After 1970 elections, he created this sense that East Pakistan, or what was then East Pakistan and is now Bangladesh, even though Sheikh Mujib won most of the power there, that still he couldn't be the next prime minister. So to cut the long story short, he maneuvered in a way that once Pakistan was broken up, he became the prime minister. He chose a military chief, General Zia, over and above a lot of other people. And he came to power. He assumed that General Zia would let him stay in power. But after 1977 elections, things again went upside down because Ali Bhutto assumed that he would stay in power and General Zia would side with him. But that's not what happened. And in fact, there was a military coup. And within 2 years, in April 1979, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was hanged by the then military dictator, General Zia. And that's really where the turning point for Benazir Bhutto comes in. So at a very early age, she lost her father.
And she wasn't allowed to attend his funeral, is that correct?
Yep. In fact, before then, when there was the case going on in the Supreme Court, she would go there in the courts wherever he had to be, and she would have a presence. But once he was hanged, yeah, he wasn't allowed to attend the funeral. And that's also because by then she had already started presenting herself as successor to Ali Bhutto's position. And seen as a young, upcoming politician, she somehow posed a greater threat to the military regime at that time than other more sort of trained politicians. So yes, she had a very sad life initially. In fact, let me reword that. She had both a very privileged life. She was educated at Oxford University. When she came back, she started running a program on television, which was about international relations. She was groomed by her father to be a political leader. But once that process started going, the reality is that very soon she also had to see all that huge power being taken away from her. And not only that, her father, who had been the main mentor for her, also losing his life. So it was, and she had to also be in jail for a number of times. So in a way, at a very young age, she suffered a lot. She went into exile. When she was in Pakistan, she wasn't always treated well by the regime at that time. So it was a very mixed bag, but still, from the word go, she was always in the limelight. As soon as Zulfikar Ali Bhutto became prime minister, it was very clear that his daughter would be the next in line at some stage.
Before we get to the 1988 election, how had Benazir's father tried to prepare her for leadership to be his successor?
He basically, as I had alluded before, he would make sure that he would train her how to have a position in the system. So in similar agreement between India and Pakistan after 1971 war, she was there. But after that, she was also at the Oxford University, where she became the president of the Oxford University Students Guild. When she came back, the space was created for her, what I had already mentioned, to run a television program where she would interview different people on international issues and share her opinion. So in a way, she was encouraged to be the leader from a very word go, both within Pakistan and elsewhere. And she was given a lot of knowledge about the international system in which Pakistan was operating at that time and even later. And so let me sort of also give you an insight into the way not just simply Benazir Bhutto, but even other female politicians have been groomed in South Asia, not just simply in Pakistan. For example, Indira Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru's daughter, she was also encouraged by her father. So in the same way, Ali Bhutto also made sure that his daughter was always seen in the presence of other leaders. She was given the option to talk to them, have discussions with them. And then she was obviously there in very significant milestones in Pakistan's political history.
So after becoming leader of her father's party, what prompted the 1988 election?
Well, what prompted was at one level General Zia-ul Haq's sudden death in a plane crash. There are lots of stories that surround as to what happened, but it was a very serious change of government. General Zia had introduced an idea that you could have a parliament, but on not based on political parties. So it was a non-party-based parliament. There was a Prime Minister, Juneja, that he had been very happy selecting. So it was all a set-up position. But then in May 1988, he dismissed Prime Minister Juneja because he wasn't listening to General Zia. And then there was an idea that the elections would still be held on non-party basis. But in August 1988, in that plane crash, General Zia was killed. And at that time then, and the Supreme Court decided that the elections should be held, but on party basis. And so, in a way, General Zia-ul-Haq's death created the space for Benazir Bhutto to contest those elections. In a very similar way, it was whole change in the way life had sort of treated her. Her father was overthrown by General Zia-ul-Haq and then hanged. And then General Zia-ul-Haq's death creates a space for her to contest elections and then be elected the prime minister.
You're listening to Nightlife, and we are speaking with Emeritus Professor Samina Yasmeen, Australian-Pakistani political analyst and University of WA and Director of Centre for Muslim States and Society. For This Week in History, we are looking back at Benazir Bhutto's victory in the November 16 election in 1988. Samina, how significant was it that she was a woman? So Benazir was the first woman elected to head of state in a Muslim-majority country.
At one level, we should look at it within the context of South Asian political structures, where women who have been groomed by male members of the family to be the next political leaders automatically become leaders at some stage, like Indira Gandhi. And because Benazir Bhutto was also in the same situation, we should think of it as reflecting the South Asian political phenomena. But where it is very different is that she was, as you said, the first female Muslim leader who was elected to that position. There's a very strange mix in the way Muslim communities, but also South Asian communities, deal with women from significant political families. So they always are more sort of polite and accepting of these women as the leaders. But what really makes her stand out is that she was very young. She was in her 30s. She was 35 when she became the prime minister. And before that, when she was running her election campaign, or even before that, when she was in exile and then came back and worked out arrangements with other political allies, which she later on then decided she didn't want to continue with that. But in all that, she was very confident. She would assert her position, and she would say in a way that she captured the imagination of people who were very tired of the military rule. It had already been 11 years. But while there were other politicians unable to have the same impact, possibly counting on her father's popularity and also the fact that he had been hanged, but definitely with her own ability to make her points understood, she just captured the imagination of everyone. And as a woman in her mid-30s to become that prime minister for the first time in a Muslim country was both part of the scene that South Asians were used to, but again, it was a very significant one that as a Muslim woman, she did that. Then, of course, there were other Muslim females who also became significant political leaders in other countries, but she definitely broke that glass ceiling.
You mentioned there capturing the imagination of the public when she was first elected, but how did that public view in Pakistan change over time during her first term?
For that, we need to understand how she managed to sell her message. So her father had introduced the idea of roti, kapra, or makan, which is bread, clothing, and a place or a shelter. And so ordinary poor people who weren't able to live comfortably or were underprivileged, they felt that he had probably not been given the opportunity to continue his project. So when she came to power, and even before she came to power and she was campaigning, she did talk about this, roti, kapra, or makan. She talked about the rights of the citizens. And she gave people a sense in a very watered-down manner, that they need to be able to have a say in the system, have some political benefits from the system. But within the 2.5 years that she was the prime minister, people started losing hope, mainly because political rhetoric is one thing, but then putting it into practice becomes difficult, especially because while she had captured the imagination of people, the ground situation within Pakistani political system was such that she had to make compromises. She didn't win an outright win in the election, so she had to form coalition. At the same time, the military also had put very strong limits on her ability to go beyond what they thought she shouldn't go. For example, on the foreign policy issue. So people basically looked at her performance and said, what has changed other than the fact that now there is an elected political leader? But there was another problem. There's a lot of talk about mismanagement, economic mismanagement. But there was also the question of at least perceptions in the community, and quite widely held perceptions, and that corruption was rampant. And when we look back into the history, that perception wasn't without any basis. Because I remember even interviewing some political leaders, and they would give me figures that while in the past for them to be elected, they had to put in a certain amount of money, because often in Pakistani elections, you don't get elected unless you bribe both the electorate and also others who would accept your tickets. But that with Benazir Bhutto's government coming to power, the amount that they had to have suddenly increased. So there was a many-fold increase in corruption. A lot of people would mention her husband, who is the current president of Pakistan, Asif Ali Zardari, as being responsible for that corruption. But whether that was correct or not, the reality is that people lost hope. That's the situation at the ground level among the people. But again, I don't want to be unfair to her or her legacy, because she was brought to power, or she was allowed to come to power within a very constrained political structure. General Zia, before he was killed, he had introduced this whole number of amendments in the constitution, which consolidated the position of the president, mainly because he himself, as the chief of army staff, was also the president of Pakistan. And the constitution said that the prime minister could stay in power till the tenure of the pleasure of the president. So if the president felt that the prime minister didn't command the support of everyone, he could just simply dismiss the government. So Benazir Bhutto, having come to power, therefore knew that she has to work with the president, who she agreed to have 5 years term. She had to work with the chief of army staff, who was really, without anyone saying that, he was really the ruler of Pakistan. And of course, she had to also deal with other politicians. So her hands were really tied. So as a result of that, people lost hope in her, but her ability to do something that could help them not lose that hope too much was also limited.
Now, some analysts have described Benazir Bhutto as charming and ruthless in pursuit of power and hanging on to it. Do you agree with that assessment?
I would say yes, but again, it's not something that only Benazir Bhutto is ruthless, and she's the only one who wants to stick to power. If we look at the history of Pakistani politics, especially in the 1990s, when she became prime minister twice over, there were other times when, Nawaz Sharif, who's now again back in politics, he was the prime minister. And every one of them tried their best to stick to power. Where Benazir Bhutto stands out is that, yes, she was charming, she was different, but she knew exactly what she needed to do to stay in power. So interestingly, she would give in to the demands of very hardcore Islamists in ways that people felt really didn't enable women to have their rights in a system that was getting more and more Islamized. But she would do that because she knew that's how she could stay in power and she wouldn't lose their support for the in remaining the prime minister. So yeah, she did everything that she could. She even gave in to the military's demand before she was allowed to take up the position of the prime minister that she would not impact or change Pakistan's policy on Afghanistan or even on relationship with the United States, which the military was worried that she might do. And whatever the military said, she gave in to that. And maybe that's where it comes to that she was both charming and ruthless. She was willing to make compromises because that meant she would stay in power. But given the way Pakistani system was working in those days, nobody could guarantee that if the president decided, especially with support from the chief of army staff, he wouldn't be kicked out.
If we go forwards to the day she was assassinated, what do you remember from that time?
Well, I remember we were coming back from Lahore to Islamabad because I was visiting Pakistan at that time. And halfway through the trip, my brother rang up from Pakistan, from Islamabad to say Benazir Bhutto had been assassinated and all the entry points to Islamabad had been blocked and that we should really be careful. So I do remember taking a very, very long route with my family, including my niece who had come after getting married. They took a very long route to come back. But it was very sort of there was a sense that it was unreal and nobody could believe that it happened. But then what I do remember straight after that is that the next day I went to the Pakistan People's Party office, which is behind our family home. And the people who were there and the way they were crying, it suddenly made me realize that as a political analyst, I'd been looking at her, judging her, assessing her performance, saying, yeah, she has set up the first women's bank. Yes, she has set up the women's police stations. And yes, she has helped people. But her performance isn't as good as should be expected. But looking at those people, the way they were crying, and I still remember this old woman who just wouldn't stop crying and saying, hi, gee, you were so nice. Gee, you were so nice. And I thought, the way she had captured their imagination in 1988, at one level she had retained that even in 2007. People were still remembering her, crying for her. And the more I look back at her life and the way she performed her role as a prime minister, but even before, I can't help but think that maybe as a political analyst I wasn't being too fair to her, thinking of her limitations as a woman, but also as someone in a different political system. But I do remember that sense of shock and disbelief that somebody so full of life, someone who had actually learned her lesson and had also started working out a good positive relationship with her opponents like Nawaz Sharif, could be assassinated just as she was campaigning to be the prime minister for the third time.
And what do you think is Benazir Bhutto's legacy now? And was she able to advance democracy in Pakistan?
She wasn't able to advance democracy, but she was able to give people confidence. And she was able to take people and their wishes into account and see what needed to be done in a very charming, as you had already said, but also more understanding manner. She dealt with people the way they needed to be dealt with. And I think she did make it very clear that if you're committed as a politician, but especially as a female Muslim politician, if you're committed to making your mark, a system can do its best to get you out of power, but then they can't keep you down for the rest of your life, and that you still can come back. So, you know, we really need to think about her as someone who had that resilience, the charm, the compassion, but also some ideals that I wish she had been more strategic in putting them into place, but she did make her mark. So if I was to compare her to other Pakistani politicians these days in Pakistan, I would think she stands way above all of them, because she has done something to raise the status and position of women in ways that others haven't. Others probably are continuing what she did, for example, in terms of the first women's bank and also the women-only police stations. But they haven't come up with things that would really think that she have taken this particular step. So I think...
Oh, we've lost Yasmina there. She's dropped off. We were coming to the end anyway of that particular This Week in History interview. That was Emeritus Professor Samina Yasmin, Australian-Pakistani political analyst and University of WA Director of Centre for Muslim States and Society. Just looking back on the 1988 election of Benazir Bhutto to Pakistan.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.